Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Reformed Forum. This is episode 131.
There's no doubt that Jesus Christ is the central focus of the book of Hebrews. What he's done through his cross, who he is as a person. The writer wants to bring out our understanding of who this person is. One of the odd things that the writer brings out is his relationship to a strange figure from the Old Testament, Melchizedek. When Abraham came back from the defeating of the kings, he came across Melchizedek, a strange figure in Old Testament history. Abraham gave him offerings and tithes. Melchizedek blessed Abraham. And now, in the book of Hebrews, this strange, mysterious figure is brought up again. Well, who is Melchizedek? Is he an angel? Is he a human? How do we know? And what is his relationship to Christ? We will discuss these and other questions today on Theology Simply Profound.
Thank you for joining us today, and welcome to another episode of Theology Simply Profound. I'm Bob Turlow. I serve as pastor here at Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Indian Head Park, Illinois. And with me, as always, is Rob McKenzie. Now, Rob serves here as an elder as well at Westminster and is also an MDiv student at Reformed Theological Seminary, Orlando. And I might also say, a published author.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Did me bringing the book and actually holding it in front of you, did that help you remember that it's out?
Well, I did know it was out. Okay. I saw your posting of it through Facebook, right? On the Facebook page, which is Identifying the Seed at Facebook. Yeah. I did also see it at Amazon, not through the link, though. I found it on my own.
Oh, yeah. No, actually, so did I. That was really cool. I mean, you know, I was looking for something else. I wasn't looking for it. I'm also working on a study guide.
Highest quality books on dispensationalism,
and it just
popped up.
Ever written, and that's what it was. I'm finishing up the study guide that's also going to be published, and it will be on Amazon. And I was looking up something in dispensationalism that had nothing to do with what I would think would bring up the title. Mm-hmm. But it was right there, like the sixth book, I thought. And I even came across, I'm like, oh, look, that's an interesting... Oh, wait, that's mine.
You know what? I was actually searching for how to identify certain seeds to plant.
And oh, well, that doesn't surprise me. Actually, no, that doesn't. When I first put in the title... Well, before it actually, the book was ready to be purchased, I did that. I put the title in just to kind of see what would come up before my book was ready.
Yeah.
And it was all farm and seeds. And there's McKenzie seeds.
Oh, really?
Canada,
there you go.
Which are like
McKenzie,
high quality.
Identifying the seed.
Yeah. Which are high quality seeds or something in Canada. So maybe as a listener, you never know. Yeah. So it can be, it's available for purchase as a physical copy, or it's also on Kindle. And if you have Kindle Unlimited, it's also on Kindle Unlimited for download.
Oh, cool. Nice. I do have Kindle Unlimited right now.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I think I'm still on the trial basis, but...
Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah, nice. I'll get a hard copy, though.
Okay, that'd be great. Anybody who actually, you know, likes the book, of course, leaving like 5 stars and good reviews really helps.
Yeah.
As far as searches.
First protocols,
it is very helpful.
Yeah, and I might also add, you know, it helps... Theology Simply Profound for those things too on iTunes.
For iTunes, okay.
I was just looking, and the last actual review with someone stating something was 2017, so that's why I kind of bring it up. Hey, if anyone is out there listening and has not done so yet, feel free to go to iTunes and give a review. And we much appreciate the 5-star reviews. You'll get a $1 in the mail.
Oh, wow.
No, well, that's a joke.
You better resend that. It's on there.
That's a joke as well.
Oh, my goodness. People are going to be writing.
Course.
And we're going to get letters now about where's my dollar? Why don't I have a dollar?
Well, because they can't take a joke if that's the case. No, we do get letters, though. That was really cool, right? Getting the letters and things in the mail.
Our listeners have always been very encouraging.
Of course they have been, because they're good listeners. Yeah. So, okay, you said we're talking about someone named Melchizedek.
Well, there is this controversy that's gone on. Not controversy.
Controversy.
A disagreement
okay.
within the church about who this mysterious person Melchizedek is. I mean, he just kind of just pops up in Genesis. And he's Abraham's coming back. I mean, he's just kind of, he's delivered Lot from and the other people from Sodom and Gomorrah, actually, and all those other cities that had been invaded and hostages had been taken away. Lot was taken away. So Abraham, I love this. He's so rich and so vast in his small little empire that he's got 200 trained guys that can go out as warriors. Mm-hmm. And they go and they bring all the prisoners back. They bring all the prisoners and the spoil. Of course, Abraham says that he will not take any of the spoil except what his men have eaten.
You're not going to give that back.
But yeah, he doesn't take anything because he doesn't want anyone to say that Sodom and Gomorrah has made him rich. Mm-hmm. And then, he hasn't gained anything. He's actually lost because it's wear and tear on his people and weapons and all that and time away from his own herds. And now he's coming back and he meets this strange figure, Melchizedek, and gives him a tithe, an offering. It's just the homage that is paid to this king is an odd story. And then
it's surprising.
And Melchizedek, what does he do? Or what is mentioned within this but bread and wine? It's like, wow, well, that's interesting.
Well, that's interesting. Huh? Well, I think, as you read through later redemptive history, as about 1,000 years later, David, but before that, Moses coming in, the institution of the priesthood. And so you immediately, if you're just reading straight through the scriptures, right, and you have this one figure, and then you have another figure who receive tithes as well. Mm-hmm. You're meant to see some form of contrast, so you have Melchizedek, this king, but also a priest of the Most High God, who seemingly also as a Gentile, right, mm-hmm. and from Salem, king of Salem, which is later Jerusalem, where mm-hmm. David establishes Jerusalem. You have almost this priesthood according to promise, mm-hmm. right? Under the Abrahamic era, the patriarchal era, and then you have a priesthood according to the law under Moses. And that's what it gets contrasted later in the book of Hebrews.
Right.
That contrast between Melchizedek and the Aaronic or Levitical priesthood, which I think we can very rightly say is a priesthood that is contrasted by promise and law. And that is the contrast and or compare contrast that's given to us for the sake of identifying the characteristics of Jesus' priesthood. And why Jesus can be a priest out of Judah instead of the family of Levi, and how Jesus can be a priest according to promise and not according to law and not according to genealogy or so supposedly right genealogy. So that contrast is wonderfully established even in Old Testament before. Right. Before we make it into the New Testament revelation, which really clarifies and yep. makes it plain for us, that contrast is there for any to see it, even though Melchizedek is so very mysterious.
Yeah.
And mysterious in such that you use language controversy or disagreement. And it's one of those disagreements that really doesn't isn't one that is, we can disagree and we're both in the same church, right? It's nothing.
Absolutely.
And we're not like talking about like major, it's more exegetical disagreement and some people, as you said, is he really a human being who was a king of this right. location in Salem? Is he a pre-incarnate figure of Christ?
Right.
Because the way that he's described later, without mother, mouth, father, right?
He's no
given
genealogy.
He's given this strange kind of description that makes him very mysterious to us. He's a wonderful figure to look at, especially given his name, right? I mean, Hebrew meaning king of righteousness, and Melchi, my king, even, my mm-hmm. king of righteousness, you can be. And then the king of Salem, and then he's a priest all at the same time. It's just really one of those figures that's really fun to look at, because he's just got all of these characteristics that are wonderful in every way, but that then contrast with what we also think is wonderful in every way, the Aaronic priesthood, you know, because you go through and there's so much symbolism in the Aaronic priesthood that teaches us about Christ according to the law.
Yeah, the Melchizedek, like you said, he's given to us, and Hebrews tells us he doesn't have father nor mother, genealogy. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have beginning of days or end of life. And so for those who want to say that he is a pre-incarnate Christ, they'll point to this and say, this here it is. I mean, this is Christ coming from, where is he coming from? From Jerusalem, from the Salem, mm-hmm. from peace. And who is he? He's the King of Peace.
Yeah.
He receives offerings. There's bread and wine. There's, you know, and we're told he has no father, he has no mother. This is the eternal second person of the Trinity. No beginning of days, no end of life. He is eternality. But when you, in response to that, mm-hmm. what one can say is, the Old Testament is giving us types and shadows.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Melchizedek can be seen as a man who, when it's referring to him as not having father, well, we're not told his genealogy.
Yeah.
Or beginning of days, of end of life. We're not told when he was born.
Mm-hmm.
We're not told when he died.
When he died, right.
This is just the writer of the Hebrews is looking at the story that we have in Genesis and is saying, look at this figure.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where he comes from. We don't know who his parents are. We don't know when he was born. We don't know when he died. But we do know that he was a priest. And his priesthood was greater than that of Aaron. Mm-hmm. In fact, Aaron himself gives tithes and offerings to Melchizedek through Abraham.
Through Abraham. Yeah. And that's what the text of Hebrews tells us, which is kind of like anachronistic, right? It's like, what? How's that happen? But let me just read a paragraph from this commentary, very readable commentary called An Unshakable Kingdom, the Letter of the Letter to the Hebrews for Today by David Gooding.
Who publishes that?
This is Myrtle Field Expositions.
Okay.
This is the one I sent you a PDF of. Available, and I've mentioned it before. But he does a very good job of being very summary and readable. It's not like reading Owen on John on Hebrews.
The seven volumes.
The seven volumes. This is just one short volume. But he writes this. He says, in Genesis, we're normally told of the genealogy, birth, and death of each of the great patriarchs and servants of God. But this great priest of God, Most High, Melchizedek, has none of these details recorded. He suddenly appears in the record and just as abruptly disappears. We are told who his parents... excuse me. We are... we are not told who his parents and ancestors were, or when he was born, or when he died. All this information is withheld. So the writer believes, by the Holy Spirit, in order to make the record of this priestly prototype of our Lord point to actual features in the Son of God, who in reality had no beginning of days nor end of life. Moreover, he points out, nowhere in Scripture are we told that this ancient priest Melchizedek died, or that his order of priesthood was superseded. As far as Scripture is concerned, his order of priesthood has no end. And that is highly significant, for as will soon be pointed out, the Old Testament did indicate that Aaron's order of priesthood would be superseded by another order. Right. So all of that to really just summarize what we've been saying with regard to the order of Melchizedek, this order of priesthood existed prior to the Aaronic priesthood. Mm-hmm. Now, it had no beginning in the sense that we weren't given the beginning.
Right.
We aren't told about how it began. And it's through a Gentile, no less, right? Which, by the way, so was Abraham before he was a Jew, so to speak, right? So that doesn't matter, but it also does speak to us of the inclusion of Gentiles later, right? Yeah. I mean, the fact that Jesus, as a priest, is according to a priesthood that was held by a Gentile. And this Gentile's name is King of Righteousness. And he comes and he's king over Salem, this place where that would later become Jerusalem, the seat of the temple, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the seat of God's earthly dwelling, we would say. that thing. And then Jesus comes, obviously, right, as the tabernacle, right? And he is the one who is the priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Therefore, he is a priesthood that supersedes Aaron's priesthood, right? So by way of contrast, the Aaronic priesthood goes away. This is how you can say later that the law changed, which in Hebrews 7:12. But anyway, I think you wanted to say something.
No, it's one of the things that
you didn't.
Really struck. Well, okay. No, I mean, you didn't have to stop is the point.
All right.
But not that you have.
Yes, go ahead. Say something better.
Okay. No, I'm just going to expound a little more on what you said. One thing that really was incredible to me in looking through Hebrews, thinking about Melchizedek specifically, is how much he's mentioned.
It
starts in Hebrews 2 all the way through Hebrews 10. Most of the book.
He's like scattered throughout. Yeah.
What happens with Abraham and Melchizedek, and then Christ being compared to Melchizedek, is extremely important when it comes to our understanding of the old covenant and the priesthood of Aaron and the new covenant and the priesthood of Christ.
Yeah.
Everything's tied into that. The new covenant is tied into this.
And isn't that interesting? When we were talking before we started recording, I was like, so what do you want to call this? Melchizedek, order of Melchizedek. And you're like, no, the priesthood of Christ. Right. And I was like, right. But that's so appropriate, right?
Right.
Because that's what the preacher to the Hebrews is trying to affirm. And once it's a lot more to it, right? Of course. But
right.
how Jesus, everything about him is better than the old. And part of that, and throughout this book, this letter, this exhortation, is his priesthood. And to show that, he goes to this little episode in Genesis 14 about this mysterious figure named Melchizedek, and he opens that up for us throughout. Like you said, from Hebrews 2 all the way into Hebrews 10 at various places, Hebrews 5, Hebrews 7 especially, are very...
Hebrews 9, Hebrews 8, Hebrews 10.
There you go, right? I mean, it's just one after the other. And he does that to show us just how much better Jesus is, and that this episode in the Old Testament actually is there for our purposes to explain...
Right,
the betterness of Jesus.
Right.
Wonderful.
Regardless if this is the pre-incarnate Christ or if this is a man, the point of the story, the literary point of the story, is he doesn't have father or mother. He doesn't have genealogy. He's a priest and he has no beginning, no end. It is an eternal priesthood. Yep. That's the point.
Right. That's the point. Yep. By way of contrast,
exactly,
with Aaron's, because Aaron has genealogy, and if he didn't have a genealogy, it doesn't move on.
Right.
Right. If the Aaronic line ended,
right,
it's gone. There's no more priesthood, and that's the point. Because this other priesthood has no beginning, no end, no genealogy. The characteristics of it are so far different from the characteristics of the Aaronic priesthood, which has to have a beginning. We read about it. It has to have genealogy, or it isn't. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And it does have an end. And that end comes with the coming of Jesus Christ.
Right.
So you see that all these contrasts are just there for us to understand better. And just by way of, putting it out on the table, I do think he was a man. I do think he was a
believe it. I don't know if I could sit at this table.
I think that is, because I don't think, Jesus as a pre-incarnate figure came to earth and ruled as king of Salem.
Right.
All right. And walked around and did all this stuff outside of his interactions with Abraham. I think we have a man who came and served in this priesthood, as a Gentile, and did these things and received this tithe because he did what he did at the call of God outside of our, the revelation provided for us. And that happened. And I think and we don't need to know the other things because God hasn't revealed it to us. But I think that this will be a man of faith, that was called by God. He is the priest of the Most High God.
Yeah. No, actually, I do agree with you. I do that Melchizedek is a man. Hebrews says that he's a man. Those who hold to him being the pre-incarnate Christ, I don't think that necessarily means that they're wrong. But Hebrews says he's a man.
Yeah, I mean, it means it's still a valid position.
Right.
And this is, we disagree, it's okay.
Yeah, it's perfectly fine. But the central point is that the priesthood is eternal, and that's what's trying that. That's what that's what Genesis is trying to bring out, and even though in type and shadow, and that's what Hebrews brings out, and it's just a great example of how we look at the Old Testament, and that it there's types and shadows. You know, Melchizedek, real person, whether it was pre-incarnate Christ or a man, still a real figure, wasn't a vision. This is an allegory, but still type and shadow.
Yeah.
Pointing to the finished work of Christ and the eternal priesthood of Christ. And Hebrews keeps making this comparison back and forth. Look, the Aaronic priesthood, the priests themselves, the high priests, had to offer sacrifices for themselves first and then for the people. That these daily sacrifices never ended. The priest had to continually give them. And through that priesthood, all it did was point to Christ, point to the finished work of Christ. It was type and shadow, actual offerings being made, real animals being slaughtered, real grain being given, real ceremony, priests that were working the actual sacrifices at that time were covered in blood. And they would have to continually wash away the blood. Why? Because Christ hadn't come yet. And so now, and this is what the writer in Hebrews is doing. He's saying, look at that. Put that in your mind daily, 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 daily. And then when they got up in the morning, they had to do it again.
Right.
And now here's Christ. What does Christ do? He comes, he gives the sacrifice, the bloody sacrifice, as the Lamb of God. He's the ram caught in the thicket where Isaac should have been sacrificed because that was what God demanded, and yet a substitute was given. Mm-hmm. Now the substitute has come, and no longer will we be able to demand. God will no longer demand sacrifices because Christ's sacrifice is the last and final and is eternal along with his priesthood.
Well, given everything that you've said so far, Rob, in this regard, with regard to Melchizedek and biblical interpretation, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really has a lot to what we're talking about when you have this one little figure, not little figure, obviously, that was wrong words, one figure in Genesis 14 that then gets expounded upon by the preacher to the Hebrews in an extensive way throughout the book, as you said, from chapter 2 into chapter 10. Of this letter. And you've mentioned types and shadows. We've mentioned the law changed. We've mentioned the contrast between Aaron and Melchizedek in the order, promise, law. How, given your studies, given your understanding, even the fact that you've written a book now on this, how do dispensationalists, our brethren, right? Not the real out there, because there are different levels. No, right? How do our brothers and sisters understand this figure from the Old Testament now expounded in the New in dispensationalism?
Yeah, I mean, whenever you ask me about dispensationalists, I always assume it's not the wacky one.
Okay, oh, good. I'm sorry.
Because there's a minority, and we're not going to deal with them. No, I think this is one of the major contrasts between dispensationalism and covenant theology. How the book of Hebrews is looked at, for one thing, you'll find within a long-standing position of dispensationalism was that the book of Hebrews was actually not for the church. It was for the Jews in the millennial kingdom, that it was explaining to them the benefits of the new covenant. Because remember, the new covenant doesn't come until the millennial kingdom. In classic dispensationalism, even through up until the progressives, you have some changes that take place within how we understand that, the relationship between Christ and the church entering into the millennial kingdom and for eternity. Those are different changes. But as far as the new covenant itself, it was always seen as that's the millennial kingdom. When Reformed theology was looking, like O.T. Alice and Wim Cox, were looking at dispensationalists saying, well, wait a minute. The new covenant, the new covenant comes in the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, and our salvation is through there. And dispensationalists would say, well, that aspect, the salvific aspect of what Christ does, in that it is associated to the new covenant, that the church receives as well. Mm-hmm. But it was almost kind of a twisting of the arm to come to that point.
To get there.
Because Ryrie wants to come out and say, there are actually two new covenants, one for the church and one for Israel, which I've never come across that in other dispensations. I'm not saying that they didn't. Ryrie's pretty influential. But the idea that there's two new covenants, it takes us down really odd roads to do that.
Would he have used Hebrews in that get there?
He would. Well, that would have been some of his supporting aspect. But again, the new covenant that the church has is really having to do with our salvation. And the new covenant that Israel has is the Abrahamic fulfillment within the millennial kingdom. Well, in the late 80s is really when progressive dispensationalism started to take on steam. Mm-hmm. And it was really from, because 1988, Jesus didn't return. The rapture didn't happen. And progressives started to build up steam. They started to teach a much more robust understanding of Hebrews. That, mm-hmm. This is talking about what Christ accomplished at his first advent. This is looking to what we are going to receive in the new covenant. This is looking at how Christ is reigning right now. So there has been changes within dispensationalism, but from the majority standpoint, either the book of Hebrews is for the millennial kingdom,
yeah,
or it's just talking about what Christ, almost their own now and not yet, that this idea of this is going to describe to us what Christ finally accomplishes. But the reason why I hesitate is because this is one of the major things that brought me, to Reformed theology is that in the millennial kingdom for dispensationalists, the temple is reinstituted, unless you're progressive, that which is what changed, but the temple is reinstituted and sacrifices are being given. Well, they're going to look at the book of Hebrews and say, yes, sacrifices are being given, and that is under the Melchizedekian priesthood. The problem with that is that Ezekiel, which talks about the new temple and the sacrifices, which is where they get a new temple from,
sure,
that's set 100% in the Aaronic priesthood. Mm-hmm. Every offering that is talked about there is the Mosaic covenant.
Yeah.
The feasts that are talked about there, the way... Everything that is set in the Aaronic priesthood. And Hebrews seems to be saying that that priesthood is over with.
It doesn't seem to be saying that. It is saying that.
It does say that.
That is the contrast.
Yeah. I mean,
that is the biggest contrast between Melchizedek and the priesthood under Moses, the Aaronic priesthood, is that it does end. And so, to maintain that, as we've said, I think before in our dispensational series, you were trying to really help me understand, mm-hmm. Because it's one of those things that still baffles me. Of course, is to the an institution of sacrifices when a new temple is established, when Christ is there before you. It seems so very unnecessary,
right?
And strange and odd if that is how some dispensationalists understand what's coming in the future.
There's a lot of dispensationalists still mm-hmm. hold to a new temple and sacrifices being mm-hmm. given. But one thing they do is they'll say, well, but these are memorial sacrifices. The problem is that there's no scripture that they can go to mm-hmm. and say, and that says these are memorial sacrifices.
Yeah.
What they'll link it to is actually the Lord's Supper. Mm-hmm. And because there's a memorial aspect of the Lord's Supper, and they don't hold, well, there is.
Mm-hmm. There is.
Yeah. And they don't hold.
Looking at my facial expressions.
I'm looking at your face. Sorry.
I'm contrasting my head. Radio. I was like, blood and wine, though. I mean, we've got a better thing now.
That's just it, though, that it's a memorial. And for dispensationalists, it's only memorial. Mm-hmm. That's why they call them an ordinance and not a sacrifice or a sacrament. And so they'll say, well, this is memorial. And because the Lord's Supper is memorial, these sacrifices are now memorial. The problem is that nowhere in the New Testament does it make that link, except they'll come to the book of Hebrews and say, well, because his priesthood is of Melchizedek, then that's the change. We don't have to look back at the Aaronic priesthood and say, well, these weren't memorial, obviously. The new, the, um, The new temple. Yeah. The new temple, they don't have to, then it's under Melchizedek. It's a big mixture.
Yeah, I mean, that's mixing Melchizedek with Aaron. I mean, because the temple is associated with Aaron, not Melchizedek.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. One of the reasons why I hesitate is because I'm thinking about a conversation that I've had with a dispensational pastor who we were going through this. And he was trying to show me that actually, and I can't remember. He was using a dispensational that I did not know, but he was quoting from his book. I just can't remember what the book is. But he was trying to answer this question by saying that the Aaronic priesthood, that there was a memorial aspect to that. He never really convinced me. But I guess the point is, even if there is a memorial aspect to that, it's still the Aaronic priesthood.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one I would be thinking of is, and you're right, it's still the Aaronic priesthood, and the Aaronic priesthood has ended according to Hebrews. Right. I mean, the Passover has a memorial aspect to it, right? I mean, that's a feast that is remembering the Passover and release and out of bondage in Egypt. There's a memorial aspect to it, but we have a much better.
But that's not the sacrificial system.
Yeah.
See,
that's a feast.
You're right. It's a feast. And Ezekiel, when it talks about the sacrifices that are in this, this new temple that's coming, because Ezekiel does talk about a new temple that's coming, and the sacrifices that are in that temple are sin sacrifices. Well, that's pointing to Christ. Mm-hmm. And the once for all sacrifice. One of the things that really stuck out to me when I was looking over the Hebrews for the study was, what does Christ do in his priesthood? What does he do with his sacrifice? He comes, he offers his sacrifice that's accepted by God, and he enters into the most holy place, and he sits down. With Aaron, with the high priest that would come on the Day of Atonement, he would enter the sack first for himself, then for the people, and he would come to the Holy Holies, he would leave the offering, and then he would leave.
Yeah.
And then the next year,
Do it all over again. Yeah.
With a rope tied to his foot.
Right.
In case he was killed.
Right, right. I mean, but the contrast then for Christ is that his is so much better, because he goes in and he enters the place, and it's not as though he's just a priest. He's a priest offering himself as the sacrifice, as being the God-man. And so he does that, not for the sake of his own sins, as the other priest had to do in the Old Testament, the high priest. He does it on behalf of others. And then, the temple curtain is torn in two, which therefore opens access not only for himself, but for all who are in him, united to him by faith, according to Paul, enter into the holy places with him. We've been raised up and seated with him in the heavenly places as well. And so... I don't see how you can get much better than that.
You can't. Well, of course, they would say that you don't get much better, and that's why the sacrifices in the Millennial Kingdom are
memorial. Yeah,
they just don't have any scripture that they can actually point to.
Do you know what they're memorializing?
The Christ, the final sacrifice of Christ.
Okay, so just animal sacrifices to memorialize the sacrifice of Christ.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think that's
biblical. I just sit here and shake my head and say, oh, that's weird. But I think it's just appropriate to say it's just not biblical. It's wrong. I mean, I'm not going to, they can be brothers and sisters that disagree on that point,
of course.
But I think it's wrong.
Right. And this is why progressive dispensationalism has done away with that.
They've moved away from
that. We are the temple. Christ is the temple.
Yeah.
There are no sacrifices in the Millennial Kingdom. There's one people of God. There's one people of God after the Millennial Kingdom, because I will say, even with progressives, they will talk about Israel as being an eternal nation and Israel being his eternal people. Mm-hmm. They just don't see that kind of separation that Lewis Ferris Schaeffer or C.S. Scofield had, where the church is in heaven for eternity and Israel's on earth for eternity.
But
they don't see that.
But you've maintained that the distinguishing characteristic of dispensationalism that continues is the two peoples of God. Right.
Well, that's what makes dispensationalism That's what makes a dispensationalist a dispensationalist.
Yeah.
Is by maintaining the two peoples of God, and progressives do that all the way you know, even through eternity by saying that Israel is an eternal nation. Where they've come closer to Reformed theology is by saying that Israel and the church, although we might maintain an eternal nation for Israel, we are all one, we're all saved by Christ, we're all together for eternity.
Okay.
And on the new heavens and new earth, there's no, it's not like Israel's the first person and then everybody that's outside Israel is the second tier. Yeah.
So much closer to Reformed theology,
it's,
as you're saying.
Moving and closer, but still maintaining the distinction.
Yeah, but something that at least we can, there's some form of identity that we have, where not identity, some sort of correlation that we can say, okay, I get that, sort of.
Yeah, no, right. There's much, yeah, it is much closer. And when you hear progressives talk, they'll say, look, there's one people of God for eternity. You know, that we become one people, and they'll talk like that. And they mean that.
I
mean,
even though they still maintain a distinction.
But then they'll also talk about Israel being an eternal nation. And it's, I don't know if they're just trying to have their cake and eat it too.
Okay. Or just out of curiosity for our listeners' sake and well, maybe mine. Are there any popular figures that we can identify with in the sense of understanding who is teaching this now?
Well, Craig Blomberg, Robert Saucy, those are kind of two of the main guys.
Okay. Not MacArthur. Well, do you know where he's at on this point?
MacArthur's in between Ryrie and progressive.
Okay. The only reason I bring that up is just because, I mean, there's MacArthur Bible study books out there. There's a lot of commentaries out there. And if anyone is reading dispensational theology, it's probably him that might be in the Reform camp just because.
Oh, sure.
He's so popular.
Yeah. He's in between.
Okay.
If you want to put him in the, I don't have a problem putting him in the progressive camp, but some of what he holds to is definitely not as progressive as like Robert Saucy or Blomberg, or Craig Blazing is another one.
Okay. And they're all at Dallas or out of Dallas?
And they've all been associated with Dallas in some way. I'm not sure if they're all still there right now. I don't think they are, but Dallas Theological Seminary, the people that are there are much more progressive than anything else.
How do they describe things like this? For on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God.
Yeah, well, they would just say that the in the millennial kingdom, that the priesthood that Christ is, he's from Melchizedek. So it's a better priesthood. It doesn't.
Okay, but so that is the mixture then. It's not an Aaronic priesthood, therefore it doesn't matter. They're saying that the order of Melchizedek is what continues, not Aaronic. Yes. And they're,
Yes, and then that's, I'm pointing out an inconsistency.
Yeah, okay, I got it.
If you go back to Ezekiel, that's Aaronic.
Yeah, of course, you know, it is.
And,
there's nothing.
And if you want to be literal, then
which they do.
And that's the millennial kingdom, then you have to place the Aaronic priesthood within the millennial kingdom.
Okay.
And Hebrews tells you can't do that.
Aaronic priesthood is dead.
It is. It's done away. Well, as Hebrews says it, it's become obsolete.
Yeah. It's ineffective. Its purpose is done.
Yeah.
Which was to lead us to Christ. And we're there.
Yeah.
And now it's no longer needed.
Right.
We're not going back. And that's the whole point of Hebrews, right?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Because we have a better, more superior high priest of the great God in heaven, and that is Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Was Hebrews 7, I think it's verse 11, 17, but Hebrews 7 talks about that because of the high priest that Christ is, that he brings perfection to us. He's perfected the order he's perfected the priesthood, but he's also perfected us.
Yeah.
Through that priesthood, that's what we're receiving is that his priesthood and his work in us will bring us to a place of total sanctification, of total righteousness, of total forgiveness.
Not done through the Aaronic priesthood.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, going back to what we were talking about earlier about what Hebrews tells us about the priesthood of Christ. Hebrews 2:17 actually links this priesthood with his humanity. Well, what's the significance of that?
Yeah, well, let me get to it and read it, first of all, so that we have 2:17 in front of us. It says, therefore he, referring to Jesus, therefore he had to be made like his brothers in every respect so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. That's 2:17, and it goes on in 18, closes the chapter out. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Well, there's a lot there, as as is often the case, right? It's filled, but to your specific question of why he had to become a man, right? I mean, a man, well, you get a little bit of the Melchizedek thing there, right? That he was a man. He actually did serve. He did something. Well, the Son of God had to become man in this regard to take on the flesh of man in order to save man. He had to become what he was going to save. And in this regard, so that he suffered when he was tempted, so that he is able to help those who are being tempted. It really does foreshadow something that the preacher is about to say at the end of Hebrews 4, referring to the in verses 14 through 16 in Hebrews 4. He says, since then we have a great high priest, sort of summing up the argument, who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. All right, so there, that's summing up why he had to be man, right? To be a priest, according to the order of Melchizedek, to do these things, right? To be that one I'm getting the language here wrong, who is able to sympathize with our weaknesses, and who in every respect was tempted as we are because he's man, yet without sin because he's the Son of God made man.
Right.
And then because of this, because of who Jesus is, because he is Son of God made man as our priest, according to the order of Melchizedek, we are told by the preacher as he's proclaiming the word, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. And you see how that sort of reflects exactly what was said back in 2:17. For because he himself suffered and was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. So that the fact that he is human being undergoing all of these things as our priest, according to the order of Melchizedek, gives us this, this pastoral sense and exhortation from the preacher saying, that's why you can come to him. That's why you can find him to be a comfort. That's because he sympathizes with you in all of your temptations and all of your weaknesses, because he himself suffered when he was tempted. He actually went through suffering. He actually wept. It's not like he just, shed a tear because his friend Lazarus dies. He felt the pain of death. And the mourning and the grief of death, and what had that painful separation. Well, and he's going to actually feel it personally when it occurs to him. So, I mean, that application, we might say, right, in modern terminology, is the reason. Well, he had to accomplish it.
Right.
And there are pastoral reasons, there are theological reasons, there's Christological reasons, there's salvation reasons, all of those things. But the preacher to the Hebrews here brings it to us in the sense and for the reason of pastoral reasons and for the someone you can go to when you're suffering through temptation. But he also, in verse 17, just back up to your original question, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. He had to propitiate, right?
High priestly language.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. He had to propitiate the sins. He had to push them away. He had to assuage. He had to appease. He had to satisfy God's divine justice.
Yeah. I think one of the greatest aspects of this is that, we've been talking a lot about Christ's function as our high priest in the order of Melchizedek in his death, burial, and resurrection to obtain, secure, and perfect our salvation. But in Hebrews 2, and this is at the beginning.
Yeah.
This is right at the beginning when it's going to talk about the priesthood. The daily ongoing function of the ministry that Christ has as a high priest is in our lives sympathizing with us as we go through temptations. And he understands what that's like because he went through temptations. He did not sin, but he felt the strain, the desire for sin. He felt that pull that we all feel to walk away from the very commands of God and his law. He felt that. And because he felt that, because he was tempted like that, he sympathizes with us. That's just incredible to think that he has a sympathy as our high priest, because he knows what that's like. And that's why, as Hebrews tells us, look, because of that, we can go boldly to the throne of grace. And that's not just, although it would include any time that we come in prayer before God, that we can come boldly into the throne of grace. But specifically, this verse is saying when you are tempted, when you are struggling with sin, come boldly to the throne of grace. That is the last thing we think we can do, especially if we've given in to temptation.
Right, right.
The last thing we ever think we can do is go to our Savior and enter the throne of grace. What, boldly? I can't do that. I'm too much of a sinner. But we've been commanded to do it. And what do we find there? We no longer find judgment, because the judgment was placed upon him. We no longer find a God who is demanding payment, because that has been appeased. God, Christ has propitiated that in our place for us. And that's why when we come boldly, what do we find? We find grace and mercy and forgiveness and a high priest who has sympathized with us.
Well, once again, thanks for taking the time to join us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. We are a podcast of Reform Forum. You can go to reformforum.org to find out about us, as well as the other episodes or podcasts, I should say, and other resources. There's written resources there at the website, so make frequent use of that website, reformforum.org. We're also a listener-supported podcast through the Reform Forum, and so please take a moment every now and then to go to reformforum.org/donate. You can do a one-time donation, or you can have a recurring donation, and see how you can help this and other programs keep going. We do appreciate that support, so thank you. But if you want to find out more about the congregation that Rob and I serve, you can go to westminsteropc.org. Or if you're looking for a congregation in the Chicagoland area more broadly, go to chicagoreform.org. Rob, what's up next time on Theology Simply Profound?
Well, next time we're going to learn about why it's better to be dead than running a marathon.
All right. Well, again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Until next time.